Plan B with Rebecca Davis. Hello, Rebecca.
John, I was wondering, is your full name actually Jonathan?
No, my full name is John. And I get very, very cross when people call me anything other than John. My sister is allowed sometimes to call me Jono. But anything else, Johnny, any of those things, no.
Message received, Mr. Matham.
but you obviously don't mind Bex, because that's part of a social media handle, or was once, or maybe still is.
Yes, Becky, however, Becky is where I draw the line quite firmly in the sand.
Okay, which I've never ventured a Becky in your direction, and I'm now very
glad. I thank you for it.
Why did you ask me whether my name is Jonathan?
It just struck me. All these years I've known you, and maybe you've been Jonathan Mason this whole time, and it tickled me.
There was a pretentious period of my life when I was trying to be a full-time actor, when I dropped the H and I was J-O-N Mason, because I thought it made me more interesting. Surprise, surprise, it made me no more interesting than if I'd gone.
I see what you mean, though. It does add a certain cool, I think.
Okay. Let me start that again. This Burumakh story that you have been following up on for Daily Maverick this week sounds intriguing.
It is. So you might recall the awful incident in Worcester, Christmas Eve 1996. Loads of kids around the ShopRite in the main shopping centre, and the Burumakh detonated two bombs there. Four people were killed in total. Three of them were kids. And 671 people injured. It was a really quite monstrous attack. And the man responsible for executing it alongside three accomplices was this guy called Jan van der Westhuizen, Jan Football van der Westhuizen. Now, he was quietly paroled in a way that was kept from the media, and it seems also kept from the survivors of the bombing, which is controversial in itself because the general understanding is that such people will be consulted before these very sensitive cases are paroled. They say they were not consulted. The Department of Correctional Services doesn't dispute this. It just says that it did have various victim dialogues with them. And they've told me that actually in those victim dialogues, this guy seemed entirely remorseless about his crime. So it's kind of a mystery to them why he was paroled. And I must say it's a bit of a mystery to me too, given that there have been reports that in the case of Oscar Pistorius, for instance, the reason why he has not yet been released is because of some degree of pushback from the family of Ruud Steenkamp. So there clearly are instances in which they take the opinions of
the Harney family people. And Janusz Valus, a very obvious example of that.
Quite so. So it seems to be at best applied really inconsistently. And, you know, I've spoken to affected people in Worcester who were really, really upset that this happened. The guy gets paroled, supposedly, according to City Press, who broke the story, on the 29th of April. He then tries immediately to flee to Namibia, which actually is exactly what he did after the 1996 bombing as well. But police had been alerted to keep an eye on him, and he was apprehended very shortly afterwards, I think maybe even on the same day. He is now, correctional services tell me, sitting in a holding cell on the Namibian border, waiting for the paperwork to extradite him back to the Upington prison where he was a prisoner until parole. Now, that also gives me pause for thought, John, because if the dates are true, this man has been sitting on the border for almost a month awaiting paperwork to take him back to the Northern Cape, which is a distance, the Namibian border to Upington. It's a distance that you could drive in a day. We are not talking this vast distance, and I cannot understand why an extradition of this type, which seems so cut and dried, would require a month of wrangling over paperwork. And that also does not give me a great deal of hope, frankly, when it comes to a far more, you know, sort of impactful extraditions like those of the Guptas. I mean, if they can't get this right in the course of a month, how on earth are they ever going to get their hands on the Guptas? But the other reason this interests me, John, is because there's been a suggestion that in order for this man to flee to Namibia so quickly, he would have had to have a fair amount of support. And he was an adherent of this bizarre racist kind of cult called Israel Vision. I don't know if you remember Israel Vision, but it was supposed to be the kind of religious belief system that drove the Burumakh. And it's premised on the belief that only white people are the children of God, that black and brown people are basically genetic descendants of Satan. So it's really kind of a very fringe, very radical kind of religious extremist group. And there are indications that this man is still a devout adherent of this group and that he was receiving support from existing members of this group while in prison. This, is, I think, is also interesting, John, because there's every indication that these far-right religious groups are not just still in existence, but really kind of flourishing, particularly in the age of social media. I had a look on the main social media sites, and the beliefs of this kind of bizarre racist cult are really being taken up quite vigorously and enthusiastically by a new kind of online audience. There are Facebook groups devoted to discussing these kind of philosophies, which have thousands of members. They're even kind of influencers now who are espousing these kind of religious messages of racial hate. And we also know that, for instance, this month, a trial started involving the leader of a kind of similar group called the Crusaders, who's been arrested on terrorism charges because he was plotting a kind of coup to reinstall a white government in South Africa. These kind of plots might seem crazy, right? And this far-right threat might seem relatively small compared to the myriad of other problems and legit security threats that South Africa faces. But it also gives me pause for thought to think about the wisdom of releasing this kind of a figure. You might say this man is, you know, over 70, Jan van der Westhuizen. Is it really plausible to think that he could go out and, you know, commit some other terrible act of terror? Perhaps it is, but the people in Worcester I've spoken to genuinely are afraid that if released, he would come back to Worcester and do something terrible to them again. And maybe it's not such an insane thought when you realize that there are pockets of support that still exist in this country for those kinds of far-right ideas. So the whole story for me around the paroling of these figures is a really complicated and fraught one. It seems to me in this situation it hasn't been dealt with at all well. But also there is reason to think that these far-right groups are still active and are drawing new audiences. And I think that that's something that we should be concerned about in general.
Very much so, Rebecca. You mentioned the Guptas, and I spoke to your colleague, Paulie van Wyk, yesterday about the appearance in court of one of the South African Gupta acolytes, Ranika Raghavan, in court yesterday, charged over the Optimum Rehabilitation Fund and the misuse thereof. And you are fascinated by her.
I've always been fascinated by Ranika Raghavan from the earliest days of going through the Gupta Leaks emails. So she is this woman who, you know, and there's that kind of cliche and it's a sort of sexist cliche about behind every man there's this strong woman working behind the scenes. That is very much true when it comes to Ranika Raghavan, who is this kind of very low-profile woman who effectively kept the Gupta empire running in all practical ways. So although her job title was technically CEO of various Gupta companies, she was responsible, as the emails shown, for organizing everything from their travel arrangements to the Guptas to the arrangements for various events, ordering them wine, holidays, renovations, etc. She referred to them always in the emails as just sirs. There was clearly this kind of very she had this real deference towards the Guptas. She was reported to be barking orders to their staff, but in the presence of the actual Gupta brothers, she was virtually silent, just this like totally compliant employee working 16-hour days. And the question is, and it's even more pressing now, John, what was she getting out of it? My colleague Jessica Bezeno previously reported that she did not seem to be making very much money off them. At the peak of the kind of Gupta empire, she was taking home about 45,000 rand a month, which is really not that much considering she was supposed to be CEO of various companies. When the asset forfeiture unit came calling, she owned a Toyota Taz, a Ford Fiesta, and a small face brick townhouse in Pretoria. Is there a pot of gold waiting for her in Dubai, as some people have suggested? Honestly, the evidence seems to suggest very possibly not. And yet this woman is still dedicated to kind of defending and upholding the Guptas' business interests here as a go-between between the lawyers, to the extent that last year, when she was in court charged with another matter related to Island Site Investments, she submitted an affidavit effectively taking responsibility to shield Atul Gupta, saying, no, it wasn't Atul Gupta using this particular bank account, it was actually me. What on earth is in it for someone like that, John? The suggestion is simply, I mean, back to cults, I guess, that she was just a Gupta devotee, in a sense. There is no indication, and maybe it's naive to think this, but there is no indication that she was taking home some lavish rewards. She was flying in coach when they flew in business class. It is an ongoing mystery to me, and I think she is really one of the most mysterious figures in the whole Gupta enterprise, and it's one that I'm going to be following very closely to see if we can cast some light on what is in it for this woman after all these years to keep defending these brothers.
It sounds like she might have need to resort to a heartbreak insurance fund.
It might, and goodness, John, you can really see you are a seasoned radio pro, because that's an amazing segue. I wanted to discuss this with you weeks ago, and then we ran out of time, and it was an idea that I saw on TikTok by a South African user, and I just thought it was brilliant. Please let me preface this by saying the suggestion is obviously for people who are reasonably financially solvent. No one is suggesting that this is a serious idea. The idea is that if you and your partner are in a relationship, perhaps one that is not a marriage, but, you know, a romantic relationship nonetheless, you should establish a joint bank account, and every month both of you have to put in, say, 500 Rand, which the money is not touched in any other regard. But if one of you cheats on the other, or simply chooses to end the relationship for whatever reason, legitimate or not, then the wronged party walks away with all the money in the joint bank account. I love this idea, John, because the idea is that, you know, relationships ending is horrible. It's horrible to have your heart broken. But wouldn't it be better, just as a tiny sweetener, if you could at least walk away with a bit of money in it for you and know that half of it is from the ex who has done you dirty?
I think it's a brilliant idea. Brilliant idea. Absolutely brilliant. Love it. Thank you very much, Rebecca Davis. We'll talk again in a week.